I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. And in a moment, we'll speak with a member of the NAACP legal team that argued the voting rights case the Supreme Court decided today.
But first, what the court decided. Essentially, the court ruled that Congress has to come up with a modern formula for deciding which states and localities need election monitoring under the Voting Rights Act. That landmarked act was first passed in 1965 to ensure that minorities, especially African Americans, could vote in places where there'd been a history of blocking them. Today, the justices said that the part of the act that requires places with this history still needing to get federal approval in order to make any changes in their voting laws or procedures still stands. But by a 5-4 majority, the court said the formula to decide which areas need that approval is out of date and Congress must update it. Emily Bazelon is legal affairs editor for Slate. She joins us from the studios of Yale University. Emily, did I have that about right?
Yes, you did a great job of describing a pretty complicated ruling about a complicated area of law. Essentially, as you said, Congress used the same idea of which states need kind of special treatment about election law when it reauthorized this law in 2006. It used the same formula that it had used in the 1960s. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, you got to come up with something that matches current conditions, not just historical ones.
Well, they've said this before, and we want to pick up on that in a second. But first, let's talk about the suit itself. It was brought by Shelby County, Alabama. It was joined by others. There are 9 states and parts of 6 states that fall under this jurisdiction, this special burden of monitoring. So first and foremost, what does this ruling today mean for them? In the interim, before Congress comes up with a new formula, do they not have any monitoring of their elections?
I think that's right. I think in the meantime, and, you know, we're not sure Congress will come up with a new formula. Mm-hmm. I think essentially the enforcement part of the law, which is called Section 5, is also going to be a dead letter. And what that means on the ground is that municipalities and states, primarily in the Old South, that have a history of racial discrimination can now make changes to their election laws without first having to go either to the Department of Justice or to a federal court. And that's taking away from people who worry about voting rights a major tool of enforcement.
Yeah. And what was the argument on the part of the Shelby County, Alabama, and others who were saying that they shouldn't be under this burden anymore?
They are saying that times have changed, that the Old South is no longer a place of poll taxes and literacy tests, and that essentially it doesn't make sense to treat the South differently from the rest of the country by imposing a greater burden on places in the South when they want to change their election law. It's an argument for, I think, a national way of thinking about voting as opposed to a regional one.
And what were the arguments being made by people in support of keeping the law as it is? That included the Obama administration and the NAACP, as we're going to hear, as Jeremy said. But what were their arguments?
Well, you know, the main argument for keeping the same kind of formula, for treating the Old South differently, is that there's still a bigger problem there with what are called second-generation barriers. So, for example, racial gerrymandering, where the state legislature will redraw lines in a state so that either you're packing together all the Black and Hispanic voters or you're spreading them out in a way that dilutes their power too much. There's research showing that's still a particular problem in the South.
Yeah. And what was the data, by the way? Did the court cite the specific data that they thought was old, or did they just say it's an old formula?
Well, the thing is, Congress actually had thousands of pages of evidence when they reauthorized the Voting Rights Act in 2006. The court referred to that and said, look, you know, even if we take it all at face value, and some of it is controversial, but even then, we're not talking about flagrant discrimination anymore. And that was the standard by which the court upheld the original version of the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And so the court is saying, Congress, if you want to treat the South differently, or if you want to have the Department of Justice overseeing election law in other places, you need to be really clear about why, and you need to show us evidence that this different kind of standard still makes sense. And I think it's going to be very hard for Congress to get it together to do that politically and just in terms of what they can actually show.
Let's talk about Congress. As you mentioned, this law was reauthorized in 2006. At that time, it sailed through with overwhelming support. But then in 2009, there was another case, sort of like this case, not exactly the same, in which the justices raised many of the same concerns and said that Congress you know, how to respond to those concerns. Congress didn't respond then. Now you have a Congress and a climate in which there are debates over whether voter ID cards and voting hours and, as you mentioned, redistricting are more directly affecting minorities than others. Very polarizing debates. Is there a sense that Congress can do now what it didn't do in 2009?
I think what's going to be really hard is figuring out which parts of the country to demand this higher enforcement for, if that model even still makes sense, right? I mean, you're absolutely right about these polarizing laws, but they have passed in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio, right? Voter ID requirements, which disproportionately burden minorities. And those states are not in the Old South. They've never been covered by what's called Section 5 in the Voting Rights Act. And so, you know, in some ways, because this is a national problem, it may demand a new national solution. And then the question is whether Congress is up to that task.
Yeah. Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate. Tell you what, you stay right there because there were other cases decided today by the Supreme Court. One, a heartbreaking case about an Indian, Native Indian adoption. But as Jeremy Hobson mentioned, he has someone who has a stake in this case. So, Emily, you wait right there. We'll go to Jeremy.
All right. Thanks, Robin. And let's get some reaction now from Natasha Korgonker. She's assistant counsel with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund that group argued the case along with Attorney General Eric Holder. Natasha, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, just give us some reaction to this.
Well, you know, today's decision was an act of judicial overreach. This is kind of like giving someone a car, but not giving them the keys. We're disappointed. And now we're really relying on Congress to step in and fix this problem.
Well, what's wrong with the idea, though, that this formula is outdated? I mean, it's based on information about voters from many decades ago.
As Justice Ginsburg recognized in her dissent, the opinion didn't really deal with the volumes of evidence that supported Congress's determination from not long ago, from just as recently as 2006. In reauthorizing Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and Section 4B. So, you know, Congress really did do its homework, and it's not the court's job to second-guess it.
But what about that argument, though, that this data is outdated? I mean, I'm looking at something from the National Conference of State Legislatures that says, in 1965, the 11 states of the old Confederacy, stretching from Virginia to Texas, had a total of 3 black state legislators, and by 2009, that number had grown to 321.
Well, I mean, I think that it's not impressive that a number went from almost nil to a much bigger number. I mean, the reality is that our brief showed that persistent and chronic racial discrimination in these covered jurisdictions exists to this day. And when Congress looked at the Voting Rights Act in 2006, it looked at 1,000 pages of evidence showing that these covered jurisdictions have a different history, and that history puts them in a different position today. And that's why the coverage was needed and remains needed in spite of the court's decision today.
What's your biggest fear about what this is going to mean as it stands right now? I mean, obviously this has been thrown back in Congress's court, but what are you worried that could happen now?
We're really going to need to rely upon Congress to fix this problem as quickly as possible. And, you know, it's not clear how long that might take, but we would really need Congress to step in as soon as possible.
Do you think Congress is going to do what's needed in your view?
I do believe that Congress will do what's needed. The opinion of the court itself recognized that Congress is empowered to come up with a coverage provision. You know, I believe that it will and that it must.
Now, this has real on-the-ground implications for elections. We obviously just saw that in the last election. But what are you concerned this is going to mean for voters in some of these southern states?
Well, I mean, this is a loss for voters everywhere because it's a significant loss in our democracy. In the short term, a lot of the kinds of changes that we have seen, Section 5 and the coverage provision block, may not be subject to federal preclearance right now. And so in the short term, that could mean that discriminatory voting changes don't get looked at a second time and that voters are going to be left on their own to try to do whatever they can to combat what's happening in their communities. And that's a very disturbing situation, particularly when you think about how small some voting changes are in local communities that might not have easy access to attorneys or that might not be able to mount a sufficient defense against discrimination in voting.
Well, Natasha Korgonker, Assistant Counsel with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And a couple of the notes on that case before we go back to Emily Bazelon with some of the other Supreme Court decisions today. We want to note that we also requested to speak with Frank Butch Ellis. He's the attorney for Shelby County. They were on the other side of that lawsuit, the other side of the NAACP. He was unable to speak with us at this time. And also President Obama said today in reaction to the court's decision that he is deeply disappointed. He says, as a nation, we've made a great deal of progress towards guaranteeing every American the right to vote. But as the court recognized, voting discrimination still exists, and while today's decision is a setback, it doesn't represent the end of our efforts to end voting discrimination. Again, the setback, as he sees it, is that the court threw out the formula for deciding which states and jurisdictions have to be monitored by the federal government and asked the Congress to come up with a new one. But Emily Bazelon, a couple other rulings today. A 5-4 decision in a case about a federal law, the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, heart-wrenching case over who should have a child, the adoptive parents or the father. Just tell us briefly more about the case and what the court decided.
You're right. This is a really sad case. It involves a 3.5-year-old part Cherokee girl, and she was given up for adoption at birth by her birth mother, who is not Native American. And then about 4 months later, her birth father, who is part Cherokee, challenged the adoption. When she was more than 2, there was a trial, and the birth father has special rights here under the Indian Child Welfare Act, and that's an important law that Congress passed in the 1970s because at the time, a lot of Indian children were being taken out of their tribes and away from their families. And so, citing that law, the South Carolina courts said that this little girl, her name is Veronica, should go back to live with her father, that even though he hadn't been involved before her birth or immediately afterward, that it was he could still assert his rights as a parent. And so she did go back, and now we have the Supreme Court decision which throws that resolution up in the air for her.
Meaning what?
Meaning that the court said, well, you know, it is possible, even in light of the Indian Child Welfare Act, for this father's parental rights to be terminated. And so that means that the lower courts will have to go in and relitigate this and try to figure out again with whom this little girl should live.
Yeah. And there was one other decision that was a victory for property rights over public rights, it seems. This was the ruling in a land use permit case. Coy Kuntz, near Orlando, Florida, applied for permits to develop the land, which was classified as environmentally sensitive. Officials were asking him to meet a series of conditions. The court said no, and they may actually owe him compensation briefly.
That's right. This is about how much the government can ask for when it takes your property. And the court said the government here asked for too much and that this landowner was being too burdened in trying to use his land.
Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And just ahead, is the Senate going too far in militarizing the U.S.-Mexico border in the name of immigration reform?
We're also going to visit with Jimmy Connors before we're finished today. Take a break. Coming up here now.